And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While both of us love other RPGs, D&D has almost completed the process of seramorphosis on us.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. In 2021, I kind of became head gnome, and there we are.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. I was born a year after D&D, so I have an irrational fear of dying every time D&D's popularity wanes. If it fades out of existence, will I cease to exist? In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
Oh, Jared. You don't have issues. You have a lifetime subscription. Anyway, after we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about evil characters in D&D campaigns. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND the Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
Back at the dawn of Dungeons & Dragons, no one was evil. Which is to say, the alignment system wasn't based on a combination of a Chaos Law axis and a good evil axis. There was only Chaos, Neutrality, and Law. Michael Moorcock and Paul Anderson were big inspirations on the early game, and the fantasy stories written by those authors arranged the multiverse as a constant conflict between Chaos and Order. In early D&D, Chaos did tend to be the default evil, even though it's really more about entropy and change. It may also have been a wee bit less confusing for an alignment argument across the decades if order wasn't translated as law, but, you know, who are we to advocate for fewer arguments that probably ended thousands of D&D groups and friendships?
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
For me, it's been a light couple of weeks for D&D. Cygnus Degore is on hold due to the GM having the audacity to be on vacation and at a beach somewhere in Maryland. I'll be missing the next session when he's back because I have the audacity to take a long weekend and go visit friends in Cleveland. No con, just visiting some friends. I did get to play Jared's Marodi game, but it was a very short session as two of our players had to leave early the next morning to go on a long road trip to see family. We picked up pretty much right where we left off, with knowing that we had friends who needed to be rescued from the Temple District as some fanatical cultist knights were about ready to burn down all the heretics that weren't Dragonborn. So we rushed right into it and got right into it. Immediately rolling initiative, go! Now, we had to focus on keeping the bad guys, the fanatic knights, busy while someone got in and was able to release the prisoners. Everything was on fire. Jared had some really cool fire on the board. Now, because Kazina is a rogue, like if she spends her entire turn moving, she can move 6 times 3. So basically she gets 3 chunks of movement. So I ended up being like, you guys keep the knights busy, I will go free everybody else. And just spent my entire first turn running, you know, kind of running around some buildings to run towards the temple where our friends were holed up. And then the next turn, I did the same thing running, and then I teleported using her special psychic stabby abilities to get in there and then start freeing everybody. As a result, I really didn't get to do too much related to the combat, and everyone else was having to fight and throw fireballs and deal with exploding knights and all this other stuff. We only really got to do about, I think, 3 rounds.
Yeah.
We spent a fair amount of time chatting, and then we got into the combat and all that. We played for about 1.5 hours, and we'll pick it up when we can.
It was really interesting to me because I was not expecting you to have 3 out of 4 of them freed by, like, the 3rd round. It's not like I expected it to go a certain way, so it's got to go that way. It was really interesting to see when there's these options to, okay, somebody can save this person, then you'll have an extra person on your side. And you just went straight in and got, like, 3 of them out by the 3rd round. So that was pretty interesting.
Well, the thing he also did to me is Kazina got in there and found out her sister was one of the prisoners. And then you had the audacity to ask me, so which one do you free first? Duh. I didn't even know Anezek was here.
I had to throw that out there because who knows? Maybe you had some weird logic why you wouldn't free her first.
The funny thing is if Kizina was a tabaxi instead of a tiefling, she actually probably could have made it in there in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
Because tabaxis get extra movement for being cats. And then you get your double move as a normal character. And then you get your, you know, extra bonus action dash as a rogue.
That is actually my favorite bit of the Soul Knife, though, where you can throw the psychic dagger and then teleport to where you threw it. That is awesome. I love that bit of the class. So beyond running that game for my Thursday night group, in the interim, since we recorded last, I also had my monthly Curse of Strahd game with my daughter and my daughter-in-law and their friend. We didn't really have any combat, but we had several dice rolls and some stress that happened, which is kind of interesting. Our astral elf cleric of Krellon is a bit of a detached person that doesn't have a lot of empathy for other people. They were on the road, and one of the things you can randomly find in Barovia in Curse of Strahd is a purse made out of human flesh.
Ew.
They found this, and Ismark, who is traveling with them, his father had recently been killed. Just out of the blue, the elf cleric goes, "Huh, that could have been your father." At which point, I decided to use the stress rules from Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft on the NPC to let them know he now has a level of stress because he cannot handle thinking about his father and the fact that he might be a purse now. It was interesting, though, because now they're very concerned about making sure he can have 24 hours of rest so he can get rid of this point of stress. And it is funny how that's actually influencing what they're doing now. It's like, no, we need to get him somewhere where he can rest so he's not useless, because he's going to be useless even if he has a negative one. And the other thing that was interesting is I personally believe that sometimes you should tell people when you're using certain mechanics, because I think mechanics in a game can be kind of like the non-diegetic music in a movie or something like that, in that it is a thing that is telling you what is pacing the story that you are participating in. So I let all of them know, we're going to roll for an encounter every half hour that you're on the road. Normally, in a heavily populated area, you would roll once every hour. And if it's not that populated, you roll like during the day and then during the night. We're doing this every 30 minutes because that's what the adventure calls for, but also it's because Barovia is a dangerous place. And it was really interesting because just knowing that they were, you know, I'm having each one of them roll whenever we make a new roll. So we're cycling through all the players rolling. I love the tension that is building up with them. They have the deed that says that they own the windmill, and they made their way to the windmill, which is spoilers for Curse of Strahd. Don't listen if you're going to play this adventure that came out like, what, 8 years ago now? But I know it's still popular. But they end up going to this windmill that they have the deed for. So they're like, we own this thing. We should go see what it looks like. And the mill is being run by three night hags who are grinding people up and turning them into pastries.
Oh, hags.
Yes. And it was funny because they kind of got a little haughty about, you know, well, you're working for us now and, you know, we may need this property sometime. And are you withholding any profits? The night hags didn't take that well and invited them to lunch. However, our blood hunter managed to pick up on the idea that they were fae. So then she starts mentioning to everyone else that these aren't just people and maybe we should be nicer to them. At which point it was kind of interesting because then they kind of shifted into this mode where they were being much more careful and using like more formal language fae would use around one another about who's, you know, in charge of who and who owes fealty to who. And I really like that because all of their characters are from the Witchlight Carnival, and we have a bugbear and a changeling and an elf. So they're all very fae adjacent characters to begin with. So they're used to dealing with the fae to a certain extent. So they managed to not have a fight with a coven of night hags with a fourth level party, which is probably a good thing for them to have avoided.
Yeah, a coven of hags at fourth level, they're asking to become part of the stew pot.
Yeah. So they made their way to Valaki. My favorite thing happened, which is that they decided to look up Blinsky, the toy maker. I loved playing Blinsky. I had a whole lot of fun. Blinsky is a very over-the-top character that makes toys that he very sincerely thinks are wonderful toys that are extremely morbid. So there'll be like things like, a little thing that'll chop someone's head off with a guillotine and then reset, and things that all children love to play with. And then he basically pointed them towards Rictavio, who is actually Van Richten. They got it out of him that he's Van Richten. They were supposed to be meeting up with him because of the reading that we did at the beginning of the campaign. And what I really liked about this, too, was once I started explaining who Van Richten was and talking about, like, the Van Richten guides, which are where he, you know, talks about hunting different monsters and everything, the Blood Hunter was just like, he's their version of Van Helsing. And it was really neat because it was just like, because she got that reference, it just meant that much more to her. So this game just gives me a lot of energy back when it comes to like running D&D, because there's nothing quite like seeing people that haven't been playing D&D that long just really latching onto it and getting something out of it.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Alignment discussions have been the bane of mental health of D&D players for decades. But one subset of that discussion is, what about evil characters? Do you let your players have evil characters? Do you have a party with all evil characters? Can you run a campaign with evil players the same way you run a regular D&D campaign? Are we the baddies? We're going to try and tackle all of this the best that we can. Now, we find ourselves in this position because Phil and Senda, on episode 361 of Pandas Talking Games, were answering a question about running morally questionable characters. By the time they got to the end of that episode, they pointed out that, you know, this is something that comes up in D&D a lot. I wonder what Ange and Jared have to say about this.
They challenged us.
They did, basically. So now we got to come up with some topic to throw back at them. But until then, we did want to talk about this a little bit. One of the points that they had made that I think is a really good point is that when you have more than one player that's playing an evil character, there is this temptation for people to one-up one another.
Yes.
And that is one of the biggest potential issues with one of these things. And this, they address that basically where they're saying, if you don't have a reason in the character's backstory for them to be morally questionable, if you don't have a goal that is driving them that may make them cut moral corners, if they are just evil because they are a nasty person, it does tend to be like, well, I have to keep proving that I'm nasty, so now I need to escalate, which can be very difficult to handle in a campaign.
We'll get into this as we talk about this concept in D&D, but I think games that draw a very clear line between what is good, what is bad, what is good, what is evil, set themselves up for these problems with people playing evil characters.
So, Ange, as long as we're talking about evil, let's lay the foundation down and start talking about alignment in D&D and what that means.
Oh, alignment. Alignment has had an interesting evolution throughout D&D. If you've been playing D&D any amount of time, even if you are a new player, you understand this axis of good, evil, lawful chaos with neutral smack dab in the middle. In the early days of D&D, there were a lot of things that were specifically tied to alignment. You could not play certain classes if you were not the correct alignment. You could not play a druid unless you were true neutral. You had to be lawful good to play a paladin. You had to be neutral to play a monk.
You had to be lawful to be a monk. But back when there was still an assassin class before second edition killed it off, you had to be non-good to be an assassin.
Yeah. And these were things that they made sense at the time because it's a way to determine what's good, bad, who's on which axis, who's against each other, and so on and so forth. But it kind of also set up these barriers that you had to be a specific way to play certain classes. I believe we talked about this several, many episodes ago about how paladins were a huge pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
Back in first and second edition of D&D, because they had to be lawful good. They had these edicts that they had to follow that meant they could not allow any wrongdoing to take place in front of them, i.e. the thief doing thiefly things, and you'd end up with just party conflict.
Yeah.
And I think evil characters are kind of in that same realm of, I have to be evil because this is what my alignment says. And back in the day, there was a fair degree of the GM having to go, well, you're not playing your alignment correctly, and telling a player how they had to play their character based on that alignment. As the game evolved, alignment began to take less of a priority. By the time we got to third edition, they had opened up the doors on more classes. There were still some alignment restrictions. I believe you still had to be good to be a paladin.
You still had to be lawful good in third edition.
Okay.
Rangers used to have to be good, and they got rid of that in third edition.
Druids were allowed to drift along the chaotic lawful spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just had to be neutral in some element.
But it was still very restrictive. And then fourth edition and now fifth edition, it's almost an afterthought. Yeah, it's there. We're not going to worry about it too much, especially in 5th edition when they got rid of some of the abilities and spells that allow you to detect alignment, detect evil, detect good, all of that, because they watered them down a lot, but it also meant we're going to get into talking about Order of the Stick. And in Order of the Stick, which is a long-running D&D webcomic, there's scenes where they're dealing with a paladin, and this storyline was specifically to show the problems of having a paladin who is so intractable. The character in the party, Belkar, who's an evil halfling ranger, he would basically hold up a sheet of metal anytime he sensed the paladin was looking at him to sense evil. Because you were left with this inability to have these shades of gray in the storyline because the alignment table said, no, these are the lines, these are the things you need to do. And it forced people into having to play evil or lawful or whatever in very certain ways.
Yeah, and I mean, there's even some little things back and forth if you go back to like AD&D where it was, you couldn't use poison unless you were evil.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because that would mean that when Wesley was building up his resistance to Iokine powder in Princess Bride, he was actually evil. Wesley is not evil. Thank you very much. Yeah, so there are just little things like that. And the other thing that is funny is that if your alignment changed in earlier editions, until you spent like a whole level as that alignment, you were taking an experience point penalty. So basically the game was rewarding you for having absolutely no character growth.
Yeah.
What's really weird is very, very early on, there was no good and evil axis to alignment. It was just lawful, neutral, chaotic. And that really comes from like the Moorcock books and from Paul Anderson's books. I think there you kind of see what alignment should have been, because it's not really that Elric was always chaotic. It's that Elric was aligned with chaos because that's where he got his powers from. He didn't himself personally think every day I must do random things. It was that these cosmic forces. And even then, it was really a lot more about entropy versus stagnation and things like that, as opposed to what things kind of turn into now in the alignment discussion. And I kind of feel like, as with a lot of things in early D&D, when things get stapled on to D&D without the context of some of the stories that they originally came from, it kind of made things a little bit more unwieldy than they should have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I think even though adding good through evil made it a little easier to understand that, you know, like somebody that's chaotic isn't necessarily evil, that adding that good through evil axis, then it shifted it from being like, I am aligned with this cosmic force to I embody this cosmic force.
Yes.
What are some examples of some evil characters that we have seen in D&D?
Let's talk about Raistlin.
Mm-hmm.
Raistlin is from the Dragonlance series. He is one of the twins in the original party in the main book.
Mm-hmm.
And he inspired so many people to try and make exactly that character in their games in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
It was either Raistlin or it was Dritzt.
Yeah.
But Raistlin was an evil wizard.
And it's funny because I know, like, if you look at the adventure and the pre-gen, it starts off saying neutral. If you read the novels, Raistlin was not neutral for very long.
No. Raistlin being neutral in the start of that book series is more a nod to how the GM might have handled that at the very beginning, knowing the player was intending to take the character down an evil road.
Yeah, and I think even like in the novels, they kind of hinted at the idea that after he took his test, they gave him the red robes, hoping it would push him towards being less evil. No, no, you're not evil. Here, take these red robes. You're neutral. But I mean, the thing that's interesting about Raistlin is he was very helpful to the party until he backstabbed them. But then after he backstabbed them, he helped them at the very end of the big storyline as well.
Because Raistlin still had this bond with his brother, Caramon.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was an evil character, but he had his personal reasons to not want the group to be completely murdered.
And it's also probably good to point out that, not saying that Raistlin was justified, but the whole point in Raistlin's mind was he was sickly. He was physically weak. The reason he basically turned evil was because he wanted power no matter what. Not originally because he wanted to harm other people, but just because he didn't want to feel weak anymore.
That's something we'll actually probably get into as we continue to talk about this. But one of the problems with people, there's a lack of maturity in a lot of people who want to play evil characters and understanding certain nuances. But as a result, a lot of people who want to play an evil character only think of the psychopathic serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
Not every evil character is out there trying to murder puppies.
Yeah, and the other ones that I was thinking of from Salvatore's books, Jarl Axel and Artemis, what's funny about them is they do kind of come into the story as villains, but like eventually they have like their own novels where they're going off and having their own like buddy adventures where they're not necessarily doing good things, but they're just mercenaries. They're not necessarily going over the top and trying to, you know, we're going to take over the city. It was more like, well, we don't have any compunction against killing people, so if somebody wants to pay us to do that, it's fine. You know, it was more that sort of thing. And yeah, I think that's a good example of like not escalating.
Jarl Axel was an NPC in the Dragon Heist game I ran.
Mm-hmm.
He is one of the options as your big bad in the game. But even if he is your big bad, he's written to be charming and manipulative, not murdery, backstabby.
Oh, yeah.
He has his goals he wants to achieve. He will achieve them at whatever means necessary. But he's also going to smile and offer you a glass of wine as he does it.
Mm-hmm.
He was very fun to play, especially since the two dumbest characters in the party were the two that ended up interacting with him. And they bought everything he said, hook, line, and sinker. It was kind of fun. But there's shades of gray. There's nuances there.
I was going to say, even though he's not in the adventure, when I ran my Storm King's Thunder, I ended up throwing Jarl Axel into the storyline in that, too, just because he is a fun character to play.
Yes, he's a very fun character to play. Artemis and Tyri is a little angsty goth.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole thing is until, you know, he was the one that's like quiet and you don't know why he is the way he is until you get like 50 books into the series. A slight exaggeration, but I mean, the whole point was just that he also still wasn't mustache twirling. His most evil trait was basically, I can't kill Drizzt. And if I can't kill Drizzt, I don't feel like I am the best assassin that I, you know, that I am. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm just saying that is a different motivation than I have to murder every orphan I see.
Another one I want to bring up, as I mentioned earlier, is Belkar from Order of the Stick. Order of the Stick is a long running D&D based webcomic written by Rich Berlew. He has been running this webcomic since the early 2000s. And when he created it, there were a couple of characters in the party that he's like, I want to do this because it's different. And one of those was Belkar, an evil halfling ranger. Belkar is an asshole, unrepentant, but he is one of the most interesting characters in the strip because he's in a party of heroes, of good characters. He wants to achieve the same goals the rest of the party does. His methods may vary, but, you know, eventually, once they get on the epic part of the journey, he's, okay, yeah, we need to stop this. We need to do this thing to stop the bad stuff from happening. It doesn't change the fact that he's ready to stab anyone in half a second.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very stabby, angry, short halfling. It adds an interesting flavor to the story, the interplay between Belcar and Roy, who is the leader of the party and the lawful good fighter, or neutral good. I don't know what Roy is, but either way.
The funny thing is, this is going to be an odd comparison. Thinking back on Belcar and other characters like him, he almost reminds me of Amos from The Expanse. And I know Amos has a very deep backstory. It is very tragic. But the reason I am thinking of him when we're talking about evil characters is when you get inside Amos's head, he's not just okay with killing people. He kind of likes killing people. He just doesn't want to do it indiscriminately. If he likes somebody, he's not going to do it. But if you give him the option to say, this person is a problem, he's like, okay, I know how to do this. I am ready to do this.
Yep.
And that's kind of the feeling I get from Belcar, too. It's not the overweening, I need to murder people all the time, but I do kind of like it.
The other gimmick character in Order of the Stick is Elan, the bard. He has a high charisma and I think negative modifiers in Int and Wisdom.
Yeah.
He wanted to create a character that was like, okay, he's really charming, but he's an idiot. And this holds through throughout the entire book.
I still remember when the strip was addressing the change between third edition and 3.5 and Belcar's weapons shrunk on him.
Oh, man. Yeah, that is one of the classic very early comics. He started the comic around when 3.0 was out and 3.5 changed everything. Well, changed a lot of things. Within a year of him starting the comic. So he made the change. When fourth edition came out, he announced, no, we're too far into this at this point. I'm not changing things. And then he had to say that again when fifth edition came. Because, like I said, this is a long-running webcomic.
So when we look at evil characters, characters that are more anti-hero than they are villain, evil characters that we're looking at from the protagonist's point of view, what kind of story arcs do we usually see those characters having when we see them in a good story?
When they're done right or when they're done wrong? Because when they're done right, like we said, with Belcar and Amos, these are characters who are undeniably evil. They're sociopaths. Mm. They will do the murder because it needs to be done, but they don't do it indiscriminately. They're still with the group because there are reasons to be with that group. They can be like Raceland. They can have a bond with one of the other characters that lets them stay with the group and kind of stay on the big damn hero path, even though their personal inclinations would take them off of it. Or they can have their own personal reasons why they're still trying to do the right thing. I had a friend who... It wasn't a D&D game, but it was another game where she made a character who was based on Maz from Lucifer, who's a demon. She liked the idea of playing this demon character who still did the right thing, even if she didn't want to. But the problem she ran into when she actually played the character is she hadn't set up a bond with another character that would be basically the angel on her shoulder to keep her on the straight, you know, the kind of the straight and narrow and doing the right thing, because she didn't have the, she needed an outside motivation to keep that character going in the right direction. She and I had a long conversation about the nature of evil characters, you know, or characters with those darker inclinations without establishing the reason why they're still with the group doing the big damn hero thing.
Another one, and I know there'll probably be some people that hear this and will be like, no, that's not an evil character, but I honestly think this is a story arc that you see with someone like Punisher, because Punisher, when written well, is a character that was hurt, so he wants to hurt other people. And some of the best Punisher stories have been when he realizes how damaged he is, but he can't see any other way to be. I think that's something John Bernthal does a great job with in the Daredevil and the Punisher series. We were talking about storylines that don't do well when they have people as protagonists. There were a lot of 80s and 90s Punisher stories that I don't think did very well, because what it was is, look how cool it is to have a quote-unquote hero that can just murder anybody that he doesn't like. And it really lost a lot of that, like, so what is this guy? He just shoots people.
Let's be honest there. On the other side of the coin, the story arcs that don't work good, people are playing evil characters because it's cool.
Exactly.
That's why somebody wanted to play Raistlin.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the coolest character in that book. It's the same reason some Star Wars fans are like, oh, the Empire, Darth Vader, so cool. He's the bad guy. You know, yeah, he's got really good theme music, but still the bad guy.
Every time you say Darth Vader's cool, I'm going to show you that one youngling's face. Master Anakin, what should we do?
I mean, we've all made characters for our games based on something we thought was cool. My very first 3.0 character was based on Legolas.
Mm-hmm.
I've made plenty of characters that were based on something I saw that was cool, but you have some people who latch onto the, ooh, this evil character or this anti-hero like Punisher or Wolverine, you know, that they're like, oh, I'm going to play that character. It just ends up being a disaster at the table because they just want the dark, cool stuff and don't understand how to do it in a way that makes it interesting and work with everyone else's story at the table.
I think we'll touch on this a little bit later, but the other thing that happens, like, even if you kind of like those Punisher stories where he's just shooting people and you think it's kind of fun, that's because Punisher's by himself.
Yeah.
And we'll get into what happens when you have someone in a party that is having that kind of fun versus what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
Evil campaigns versus just having an evil character.
Evil campaigns are a choice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recommend them, but they are a choice. You can choose to do an evil campaign, but you have to be very mindful and careful about how you set that campaign up. Otherwise, it's going to just be however many players you have in that game trying to one-up each other, being as awful as possible.
Yeah, and that's one of the things Senda was talking about with a D&D game that she tried to run in college, where everyone made evil characters and they proceeded to destroy an entire village before they did any adventuring.
The only time I have ever played a quote-unquote evil game, it wasn't a campaign, it was a one-shot, and it was superheroes, it wasn't D&D. The only time it worked was because it was essentially based on the Suicide Squad.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bunch of minor villains asked to go to Africa and fight Nazis. And the whole concept was, is yes, they're criminals, but they're not that evil.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it was basically that contrasting level of darkness that made it interesting. And that game was from over 20 years ago at this point. And so I had no idea who the Suicide Squad was at that time. Other games I have tried to play that were, we are just evil, were exactly what I described before. Everyone at the table just trying to one-up each other.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to be careful.
There was a campaign that a third-party publisher put out for Pathfinder. There was an adventure path, and it was specifically designed to be an all-evil party. And the way they framed it was basically the kingdom. There was a compact at one point in time where all of the gods were allowed to have their temples within, you know, this domain. And the god's church that was, you know, primary in the country basically had this crusade and drove out Asmodeus's church. And this is all about Asmodeus recruiting your characters who are all in prison for doing something and recruiting all of them to start getting back at the kingdom. And the ultimate point is, because it's Asmodeus, he just wants to prove to them, you can't get rid of me. And it's an interesting thing. I don't know how well it would have hung together, but I did notice that they specifically try and frame this with, like, Asmodeus being a more lawful god that likes to deal with contracts and, you know, letter of the law versus spirit of the law and things like that.
Many years ago, my friend Scott, who runs the Cygnus to Your campaign, got to play a one-shot run by Keith Baker,
mm-hmm,
set in Eberron. And it was very specifically a party from the country of, I believe it's Carnath, which is ruled by, not that everyone knows this, but it's ruled by a vampire. They have a lot of necromancers, a lot of undead. The party was specifically undead monsters.
Mm-hmm.
There was a zombie, there was a skeleton, there was a flaming skull, you know, like all of them were, you know, leveled up the same level. But it was a party of evil characters. But the whole thing was, is they were part of the Carnathy army defending their border against invaders.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, yes, it was an evil game, but they were trying to protect their home.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I think is interesting is, are you talking about an actual evil campaign where your goal is to perform evil, or are you talking about a campaign where everyone is evil, but they just have a job to do?
Right.
And what makes me think of that is, if you've ever read Glenn Cook's Black Company books,
mm-hmm.
they're all mercenaries. They are not good people, but they also don't necessarily go out of their way. It's just that when they're fighting these wars, they're not, you know, they're not knightly and, you know, dealing with honor or something. They will stab someone in the back. They will burn down houses if they absolutely have to. They aren't good people, but they also aren't like, again, they're not the mustache twirling, we're going to rule the world. It is, this is my job. This is the way that I make enough money to eat.
Yep.
Now, I don't know that I would want to run a campaign where I was constantly throwing something in their way where they had to choose between taking the moral high ground and watching them take the easy way. That's a whole other thing to consider, is whether you as a GM are able to provide what they need out of these situations. We had a group in a Star Wars game, and this is when I was a player. I was playing an Authorian healer, and I specifically wanted him to have a fall and redemption arc. And I told our GM this. This was not a thing where I was trying to be super evil. It was that if anyone even looked like they were going to harm someone I cared about, I had learned how to just take my healing ability and turn it the other way and like stop their hearts and things like that. It wasn't like me going completely over the top. It was having that idea. But as we said, other people were not on board with this. And I literally had other players using Jedi mind tricks to keep me from playing my character.
Well, if I remember correctly, to be fair, it wasn't that they weren't on board. It's that they didn't know that that was the plan.
Well, no, I explained a little bit of this to them. It's just that they assumed that because I fell to the dark side, I was going to be doing what we've been talking about. Like, you're going to be going over the top. You're going to be doing this. It's like, no, that's not really what I was thinking of for him. And I don't want this to be a long digression into the dark side. This is just a story I wanted to explore.
Yeah.
So that's definitely something that you need to make sure everybody is on board with before you try to do it. That brings us to our next topic. What goes wrong in evil campaigns, or when you have evil characters in a campaign?
PvP.
Yes.
You have to be very upfront with your players at the beginning, whether you're willing to have PvP in your game.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't clarify that up front and then you allow an evil character in your campaign, you're setting yourself up for having to deal with the party destroying itself. Because
mm-hmm.
eventually either the evil character is going to be like, I'm just going to stab everyone in their sleep. Oh no, I don't know how this person died in the night. Or you're going to end up with the good characters or the not evil characters realizing something's going on with that guy and causing chaos. Years ago, I played a D&D game, one shot at a con, where it was Eberron based. We had to go into the Mornland, retrieve an artifact, all well and good. Everything was going great. We got the artifact out of the Mornland, and that was when one of the other players showed that they had been on a side mission. They were evil, and they were now here to retrieve the artifact for their mistress and kill us all. And it was like, this was fun up until it turned into PvP.
And we had a similar situation in one of my Star Wars games that I believe we've talked about before too, where I inherited the game from another GM, and one of the players was playing an Imperial agent that was posing as part of the rebellion. I sat down and had a talk with him and said, you're going to get orders that tells you to work with this cell until we get to what I consider like the end point of the campaign. So until then, just kind of be chill. We know you're going to be sending information off and all that. He proceeded not to be chill at all. He literally got one of the other characters whipped by an Imperial for being impertinent when they were going to let her go. Yeah, that just completely fell apart. And what I tend to do now in any game that I run, and I know none of you do I really actually worry about this? But I usually put in my campaign standards, if there is going to be player versus player, you need to talk out of character and decide what you're going to do first before we ever do it. It's not going to be something you do off the cuff in the middle of a fight where you stab somebody else in the back. We need to stop and discuss this before we ever do it, because that's going to create a lot of hard feelings no matter how much you think that everybody's been playing in character as soon as that happens.
These are things you need to keep in mind for any campaign you are running.
Yes.
Because you can end up with tension between characters regardless of their alignment. It's just if one of those characters happens to be evil, it's almost a foregone conclusion that this is something that's going to have to happen.
That's one of those things that's important is, if you have an evil person in the group, does the group still have a reason to all be pushing in the same direction? And to use Raistlin as an example, Raistlin didn't want the Queen of Darkness to win either. So there you still have this idea that he is going to be on the same side with his former friends and his brother, because he doesn't want Takisus to be in charge of Kryn. And that's part of why he like shows up in Naraka and then backstabs the, you know, the people in the dragon armies.
When I was playing a Tyranny of Dragons campaign, there were a lot of secrets among the characters. One of the characters was set up as he was a dwarf wizard who had been cursed to be a dwarf wizard by Bahamut because he had been a dragon who slaughtered a village out of spite. His beloved half-elf, elf lady friend had done something wrong and he got mad at her and he killed her. And, you know, like, just a flash of anger, and she was dead, and oh no. And the villagers who witnessed were like, oh no, no, it's okay. It's okay, we know you were probably right. He got mad and destroyed the whole village because they didn't tell him he was a bad guy. His whole character journey was supposed to be one of redemption.
Mm-hmm.
He had been cursed to be a dwarf wizard by Bahamut to help in this journey to prevent Tiamat from rising up, and like he was supposed to learn his lesson in humility, because I think he was supposed to be a good dragon originally. The guy playing this character played him absolutely insufferably. He was arrogant. He was always rushing off on his own and getting mad at the rest of the group because they weren't there to help him. There was one instance we had where we were traveling through a forest and a dryad got sassy with us, and he threatened to fireball her forest for basically being a smartass. He was just constantly grating on everyone. And then we got the big reveal, and, you know, he got his memories back. He found out who he was, and he was just as unrepentant. He was still a jerk. He still had, you know, like, and I get that there was supposed to be a degree of playing that draconic arrogance, but it just fell so flat. And it got to the point where the group had to have an in-character and an out-of-character conversation at the same time. And I had to kind of put my foot down. And I'm like, I do not want the next year of this campaign to have us all having to role-play around babysitting him because he was sent on this mission by Bahamut. He has proven he cannot do what he was sent to do. We should not have to put up with him. A couple of the players had been trying to like, well, I don't want to kick a character out of the party. But it's like, no, he's proven to be an unrepentant, evil character. We should not have to put up with that. And so the player ended up being like, yeah, I get it. The character went off on his own and the guy made a new character. But it was still very much this, he could have saved it if he had understood the repentance he wanted to have for the character. He needed to be role-playing that along the way, and he wasn't.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those things where, and I think we're going to talk about this in the next topic, but people don't always see the templates that they should be using because they don't associate some of these characters with that same story. I would not say that Thor, for example, was evil. But this is very much Thor's story arc.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, like if you watch the first movie, this is Thor's story arc. And if you watch that, you get the idea of him kind of going from, okay, I'm a fish out of water, to assuming that, you know, as soon as something goes bad, he must be worthy because he's going to be the one that has to take care of it. And then in the end, he's not really worthy until he's willing to make that self-sacrifice.
Right.
And that's kind of the arc that you want to look at if you're going to model something like that. Even though Thor was not portrayed as being evil to begin with, he was just an arrogant jerk.
We could do a whole other episode talking about lone wolf characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's either the same thing as somebody wanting to play that reluctant hero or somebody wanting to play the lone wolf. You still have to have the reason why that character is with this party and doing these things.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times players will be like, this is my character, and then they do everything to get in the way of the story progressing, because, well, that's not what my character would do. My character's going to go off by himself and do his own thing. Yeah, but the party's going this way. My character doesn't want to go on this adventure. Why would I do this? Okay, make a new character.
Mm-hmm.
You can do these character types. You just have to also lean into why that character is with these people and going along. And that same thing stands for an evil character.
Mm-hmm.
Your GM is willing to put up with it, and I personally am not that GM. I really want my players to be the big damn heroes. But you have to have a reason why your character is still working with the party for mutual goals.
Yeah. Just a few days ago, I was watching a thing where someone was talking about Claremont's progression on Wolverine with the X-Men. At first, for a long time, you don't know why he's still there.
Yeah.
He is just this murderous jerk that doesn't like taking orders. And it was really when they did the arc where he goes to Japan and he starts learning more about the culture and, you know, he meets Mariko and all this. And part of that was Claremont trying to show that the reason he stays with the X-Men is because he does want to learn to be a more calm and peaceful person. He just can't admit it to them.
A lot of people will say one thing,
mm-hmm.
but need something else.
Yes.
Wolverine would say he didn't care about anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But deep inside, he did need those other people.
Yeah.
And he wanted to be with them. And you can have a character that's like that. You just have to understand those kind of nuances in your head and make sure you're playing that character in such a way that the rest of the group is not like, why the hell are we dealing with this guy?
And that's also when you start seeing him being like the father figure to some of the younger women that joined the X-Men, which started like with Kitty, but then it goes on with Jubilee.
Yeah.
You know, that idea that you see there who he is willing to protect and who he's willing to go out of his way for, because he figures everybody else is an adult, they can take care of themselves.
Yep.
Here's the thing that I think is very interesting about a lot of the stuff we have been talking about, especially because we keep bringing up these characters that come from media where there isn't something stamping them on the forehead saying they are evil. We're just talking about how they are following an evil storyline, the kind of storyline that an evil character might have. So does it change this whole discussion if there isn't anything like an alignment saying you are evil? You just want to play somebody that has a troubled path or negative traits or things of that nature.
I think it does change things because you can have these characters with these darker inclinations, these darker traits in other games that don't have alignment systems, and have them work a lot easier because there isn't this black and white assumption of good or bad,
mm-hmm.
these hard lines of what is accepted and what is not. You can have more nuance in games that aren't specifically saying good and evil. I, years ago, played, it was the only game available at a con. It was an evil World of Darkness game, Werewolf. I love Werewolf.
Mm.
And it was all characters from the evil werewolf tribes. And it was an awful game. It was just bad because it was really, like I said, it was just a bunch of people trying to one-up one another.
Yeah.
World of Darkness ends up with this same problem that D&D has because they have their various groups that they have defined as they're on the correct side or they're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily want to call all of the quote-unquote the Camarilla is good or, you know, in the other groups, but at the same time, there's still these very clear distinctions of, you know, I hear my friends talk about playing Sabbat in LARPs and stuff, and I'm just like, yep, you're all just chewing on the scenery. Go on, you have fun, but it's definitely not the type of thing I would enjoy.
And the thing is, even though I said I was trying to play this character, and I love Star Wars role-playing games, I love Star Wars, Star Wars has that same problem, because once you say someone has fallen to the dark side, it's like a label. I have to prove that I have fallen to the dark side. This is a thing that is now true about me. Therefore, I have to act a certain way, which is really interesting psychologically when you really get into like what happens when you tell people that they are bad people and how that sinks in.
Yes,
that's a whole deeper thing, but it does actually kind of play into this whole thing where when there is something that is like a label that sits on a character that's right there on the character sheet telling you this, I think that drives you to doing things you wouldn't necessarily do when you would just play the character as having bad traits. Even like when I brought up Amos, you were saying basically he just doesn't feel bad when he kills people, and sometimes he likes killing people. But you don't sit there and look at Amos and go, 75% of the time he is being evil. But if he had an evil alignment, that's kind of what you're saying.
Right. In City of Cal's campaign, Alaric is our Tempest cleric. He's essentially a Viking. He's one of the Northmen, come down, ended up in the city, joining with the group. He is chaotic neutral. He follows a chaotic good god, and his character arc has been trying to live up to his god's expectations and be a better person. And the player does a really good job of kind of balancing the inclination to be that chaotic neutral character and just take what he wants or do what he wants. And we have had storylines in the game where he crossed a line and Cord ended up punishing him.
Mm-hmm.
We had some of the bad guys' minions, and he did some very brutal things to them to send a message to the bad guy that we were all like, whoa, man, that's a little too far. And Cord took his powers away.
Mm-hmm.
It was only like a couple of sessions where this was an issue, but it was still like, this is a story, and it's been really interesting to watch. Because he has those inclinations to not be a good character, not playing evil, but he definitely, like, it's a struggle for him to live up to the ideal that he's supposed to. He's able to do it because we're a group that's willing to allow the flexibility within these and not be tied to that specific box on the alignment chart.
Where I'm at now with D&D and alignment, I am fine with law and chaos and good and evil being cosmic forces. I'm not good with mortal creatures with free will being lawful good or chaotic evil or anything like that. So like when you're talking about an angel from the seven heavens, I am picturing this as something that is feeling certain things are good or certain things are lawful on a scale that a mortal will not feel them. So if they have to murder 1,000 people because in the long run they have seen this whole, you know, thing play out and those 1,000 people are going to be a problem, that may actually still trigger as lawful good in their head because they have seen the outcome of what those 1,000 people are going to do. I'm not saying I pull that lever very often. That's an extreme example. But, you know, it's my point is mortals aren't going to be able to look at that same situation and say, this is what you should do or this is what you shouldn't do.
Yeah.
That's a cosmic force that is beyond them. Now, the way I do kind of view alignments and mortal people. And just to wrap that up, like anything that is like extra planar, angels, devils, demons, those can have alignments because they pretty much are the embodiment of a cosmic force. So I'm cool with that. Anything that's mortal has free will. Nope. You don't have a real alignment. However, I think it's not a problem for people to have an alignment that they think that they're following. But this is where Jared is about ready to touch the third rail. Much like some people say they follow a religion and don't actually, you can believe that lawful good is a good philosophy that you think you are following and not be following it.
The alignment chart is very simplistic and doesn't really represent the complexity that actual people can have. Now, we're playing characters in a game, so they don't have to have the same level of complexity as actual humans do. But I think it's also a mistake to try and fit those characters into those boxes.
I've been really de-emphasizing that. I don't want to take it completely out of the game. And it is a decent shorthand for the GM to know this is the purpose for this creature. That's fine, but I don't think it has that much utility for characters these days. I honestly don't. I think it's more important to know somebody's motivation, to know some of their backstory, you know, to know what would trigger them to do this in a certain circumstance. I think those are all more important things than just hanging an alignment on somebody, because then it almost backfills the other direction. Instead of saying, because I feel vulnerable and because people have taken advantage of me, I am lawful evil. Instead of saying, why am I lawful evil? I don't know. I'm lawful evil first. I'll come up with a reason.
Right.
You know, it feels like it should be one direction and not the other.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's my question. Have we determined if you should or shouldn't attempt an evil game or have an evil character? I have some thoughts, but they are in multiple places. What do you think?
I'm going to give the immortal words of Sean Kelly from Gaming and BS. It depends. It is completely a personal choice for you as a GM whether or not you want to attempt this. It is completely in your court if you want to try it. And I'm sure there are people out there who have had absolute blast, you know, running an evil campaign or having an evil character in their group. I know for me personally, it's generally going to be something I'm going to avoid. If I have a player that I trust come to me and say, here's my character idea, this is kind of like what I'd like to do, I might allow it. But as I said earlier, my inclination as both a player and a GM is to be a big damn hero.
Yeah.
I want my players to be big damn heroes trying to do the right thing and help people. And I want them to be complex and interesting and struggle along the way to do the right thing sometimes, but I still want them trying to do the right thing. Same thing for my characters. I want them to try and be better people. I figure I personally want a lot of the evil in the world to go away, and I can't make that happen, but I can make that happen at our table when we're playing a game.
Yeah.
So, but that is me. Those are my choices.
Yeah, I am more comfortable thinking that a character could do morally questionable things, not because they want the world to be a more morally questionable place, but just because it is a failing in them. And that feels different than intentionally wanting to run an evil campaign.
Yeah.
I think one thing that I would say, one, if you are not comfortable with this as a GM, you are a player too. Do not feel like you need to do this just because you have players
Yes.
that want to do it. There are some things they need to explore with other people that are comfortable doing that.
You as a GM are completely within your rights to set the parameters for the characters in your campaign. And if that includes no evil characters, that is totally fair.
The other thing that I would say is that if you're going to let a character be evil, you really should ask that person why. I think it's even worth it to say, if I told you you had to make this character neutral, but you have the same personality traits, would you play them the same way? Just to explore that idea, like, do you want to play these traits or do you want to play this title? As far as the all evil party, that one is rough. I have a lot more leeway for someone wanting to play a morally questionable person than I do having a morally questionable group, because then it does feel a lot like they're making the world a worse place as opposed to dealing with their own shit.
I think it can be done if you're willing to lean into, like we said earlier, Suicide Squad, the Black mm-hmm. Company, or the Keith Baker game where he had a party of evil undead monsters defending the borders. You can have it, but maybe give them a larger goal than just running around the countryside. We already have a problem with players being murder hobos
yes.
in D&D games. You don't need to make them evil to make that even worse.
And I know you shouldn't necessarily just say, well, it's in the book, so I have to allow it. You really should only be doing things you're comfortable with. However, I will give Kobold Press props for this. If you want a version of D&D that does not have alignments in it, Tales of the Valiant does not have alignments in it. What they've done with a lot of like the monsters, like demons or devils, is they will have a tag that says evil on that monster. So that if something in a magic item or a spell is keyed towards that, it still works on that monster, but your player characters do not have these traits. This is not a thing you fill out in your character.
Yeah.
You have like your adventuring motivation, and that's why you're doing this.
I do think if D&D didn't have alignments at all, an evil character would not be the same problematic thing.
As much as I love D&D, and as much as I don't even necessarily want to see alignments go away, I would actually love that solution. It's just a tag that you put on a creature. Like, this creature is lawful.
Or like what you were saying before, it is something only extra planar, like mortal beings do not have this. They're too complex to be a single alignment. But extra planar things, other non-mortal things might have those tags.
My whole thought process is falling for like an extra planar being like an angel isn't necessarily turning evil. It's no longer being able to just see single-mindedly and starting to see things like from a mortal perspective and going, what am I doing?
Yeah.
I am questioning myself now. So that was just my side thing there. So yeah, don't do it if you're not comfortable. Make sure you plan for it. It is not something you should do off the cuff.
Yes.
Now let's join Edge and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to the listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that Think will enhance your D&D experience. First, though, our Eldritch Invocation.
Clacto. Burrata.
Necktie. Nectar. Nickel. It was definitely an N-word.
We've got a Patreon now, so if you'd like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we'd love it if you decide to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material like the map Chris made for the campaign he's running that we are currently playing in. It's cool. Go check out our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/thack0wa. Now, for the thing I want to give a shout out to, I actually mentioned this earlier, but I really, if you've never checked it out, please go check out Order of the Stick. It is one of the best D&D comics out there. It is delightful. It is written and drawn by Rich Berlew, and it has been running for over 20 years, from the height of the webcomic era to now. It started as a silly look at D&D. The bit with a monster dying as a character remembers their forgotten bonuses is a classic one from the early days, but it has grown into something way deeper and more epic. It is in the end game now. He only releases comics about once a month or so, because I know he's had some health issues. But there is a huge back catalog. You can buy the collected books. It's really worth some of your time. I highly recommend going and checking it out.
So I know we don't normally do like a D&D news thing, but we just had D&D Direct, which talked about everything that's happening the rest of this year and a lot of what's happening in 2025. So I did kind of want to touch on the things that they went over in D&D Direct. For one thing, there is the whole thing with what tool set you are accessing on D&D Beyond. This happened before D&D Direct, but I feel like they resolved it very quickly so that it was over before D&D Direct happened. Originally, all of the character sheet material for spells and items and gear and rules elements were going to start pointing towards the 2024 rules as soon as they release. So in other words, they were treating the 2024 rules kind of like errata. So if you have Cure Light Wounds now on your character sheet, even if you have a 2020 or 2014 version of the cleric and a 2014 subclass for that cleric, which you can still do, if you have Cure Light Wounds and you looked it up, it was going to show you the one that does 2d8 plus whatever instead of the one that the 2014 one does. A lot of people weren't happy with this, especially since a lot of people not even aren't planning on going to the 2024 rules, but are like, I have a campaign that might be a few months before I'm ready to wrap it up, and I don't want to jump into this right away. They reverse that now. You will be able to set up which rule set you want to reference on your character sheet, so you can go all 2014 or all 2024. They were never getting rid of the 2014 rules. That was a weird rumor that started. It was just that it wasn't going to be what the character sheet pointed to, and it wasn't going to be what the hyperlinks were pointing to anymore. You could still go into the compendium and find those rules. It just wasn't going to default to them.
I'm glad they backtracked on that.
I am very glad to, especially like I don't want to teach my Curse of Strahd people all of the new things in 2024. I would much rather finish up this campaign with the 2014 rules.
Yeah.
They rolled that back right before D&D Direct happened. At D&D Direct, they talked about everything. We know we're having the Player's Handbook and the DMG are coming out this year. At the beginning of next year, it's going to be the Monster Manual, and there's going to be a new starter set, which is going to be based on the Keep on the Borderlands, coming out in fall of 2015. there's going to be a new Forgotten Realms Player's Guide and Forgotten Realms Adventure Guide. So there's going to be a DM book and a player book for the Forgotten Realms. I will say, Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, not my favorite source book. It is kind of thin on actual detail, so I'm hoping that this is a little bit more in-depth. For example, maybe it will tell you that there are villains in the setting instead of just saying that, you know, you're sitting here waiting for one of the adventures to get published.
I have a little window into that one, and I think it's gonna be better. The rumor I heard from the horse's mouth, so to speak, there's gonna be kind of gazetteer sections of the book talking about different regions, so it's not gonna just be the Sword Coast.
Yeah, they did mention like the Dale Lands and Calamshan and Moonshay Isles, so it'll be nice to see a few more areas covered again.
Yeah.
And they also mentioned that there's going to be an anthology book that's going to have 10 adventures that all are themed about dragons. Because it's half the name, so we're going to have an anthology that's just dragons. What was interesting is they did not mention a couple things that they have mentioned in the past, which is before the 2024 rules rolled out, they had kind of said there was going to be an adventure based on the Red Wizards of Thay. And I can see that being kind of tied into them releasing the new Forgotten Realms books that are coming up, but they did not mention it during D&D Direct. So I'm just wondering if maybe they don't know where that's going to hit on the schedule, so they didn't want to bring it up yet. The other thing is there's going to be an adventure that features Venger as a villain that has the D&D cartoon kids in it. They've mentioned it a couple times. They didn't mention that on the schedule either, but they've been talking about that even more recently than the Red Wizard adventure. That's another one they probably don't know when it's going to fall in the schedule, so they didn't want to... I mean, they didn't give specific times for any of these, but I understand. The other thing, though, that I wanted to throw in there, because this is kind of interesting, D&D Beyond is still getting more third-party 5e material in there, and one of the new things that's going to be in there is Free League's Lord of the Rings RPG, which is the 5e SRD version of the One Ring. That's kind of interesting that they're getting that on D&D Beyond, because that's a little bit more of a drift than... Like, the Kobold Press stuff is still kind of just D&D, but with their spin on it. This is kind of using the 5e rule set, but it's doing something a little bit different with it.
Yeah.
So that'll be kind of interesting. We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like...
Misdirected Mark Plays. Phil, Chris, Bob, and Jerry play through a campaign and then talk about game mastery and game theory in relation to that campaign. You can hear their most recent series, The Children of the Shroud, a Cortex Prime game that they put together. It's complete. You can go binge it. And you can listen while you wait for their next campaign, which is coming soon.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.